So I have the list of questions I sent you, but we'll work in other questions. So the first question is just, what is your title and how did you get to the career you have?
Do you want me to use this?
Oh, yes, please. That way we can record. Thank you.
So my name is Amber Carverly. I am a licensed funeral director, also often referred to as a mortician, but licensed funeral director is like the more correct term of or way of saying it. And I run Undertaking LA, which is a small mortuary in Los Angeles.
And I'm Sarah Chavez. I run a nonprofit organization called the Order of the Good Death. But on one level, what I really do is I'm an activist. So I am helping to move a social movement surrounding death education, about getting people educated and comfortable about talking about death and grief moved forward. So there's the nonprofit kind of businessy aspect to it and all that stuff, but it's also a social movement at the same time. So there's a lot of different levels to that.
And what type of schooling did you need to get to where you're both at?
I actually, to be a funeral director, very minimal education. You just need essentially an associate's degree, and then you just take your, you major in mortuary science. I also have a bachelor's in women's studies. Very useful, as you could imagine, but wonderful. I had amazing, inspiring professors, and I actually really do credit them with putting me in the position that I am now, because they really sort of pushed me forward to be really passionate about creating change, which is why it's so amazing to work with Sarah and the Order of the Good Death. But as far as just being a licensed funeral director, just getting a associate's in mortuary science.
And sorry, quick follow-up to that. So I saw that Cypress College offers schooling. Is there any other college in Los Angeles that one can go to?
No, there is not. There is Cypress College, and then there's American Rivers in like Sacramento. Yeah.
So my answer is really complicated because there is no straightforward answer. And I think that applies to a lot of the people that are order members, that are members of the Order of the Good Death, in that these were people that are really pioneering a new path. They are inventing things and creating things and doing things that have not necessarily been done before. So whether it's a colleague of mine that is creating a mushroom burial suit, or our boss who is a mortician who is trying to, from the inside of the industry, change it, to an activist like myself, there is, because we're inventing something, because we're creating something that's new. And this also applies to Amber, because she, it's not a conventional funeral home. Undertaking LA is an alternative funeral home. It's something very different from what is offered by the standard industry norm. So there is no kind of set pathway, but there are jobs and things that I've done that have helped me tremendously. So I was a teacher for many years. I actually went to school and intended on being an opera singer. I went to the High School for the Arts here in Los Angeles. I won all kinds of scholarships and started out having a great career really young, and that's just not something that I wanted to continue on with. I wanted to do something that really was hands-on and helped people in a different way from the way that performing arts did. So I ended up being a teacher. I taught physics and I taught early childhood. So a lot of the tools that I learned being a teacher really, really helped me a lot, because the system that I was teaching in had a pedagogy that was very different from our normal accepted ways of teaching and parenting. So I was able, in advocating, learning how to advocate for different ways of doing things that are not accepted socially and that are different or deviate from the norm of how we bring up our children or teach our children, I'm able to carry that over into what I'm doing now, because I'm talking about doing death and grief in an extremely different way. From then on, I went to be a museum curator and a historical site of Old Railroad Hospital here in Los Angeles. And kind of everything that I've done on my career path has helped me in some way, shape, or form kind of create this career that I have now.
Thank you. For either of you, are there, since there is the one school, do you have interns? Is there internship opportunities? Also, do you have opportunities for high schoolers to shadow you for a day or anything like that?
Yeah, so we don't do internships. If you go into mortuary school, part of the requirement now is to do an internship. I feel like I want to say that I've looked into offering internships before, and there are so many requirements that I got a little jittery about offering for shadowing. And also, it's undertaking LA operates differently than most funeral homes. So the stereotypical idea of a funeral home is probably, if you've seen Forest Lawn or Rose Hills, you think of this giant sort of place where everything is in-house. And the reality is that very few funeral homes can operate that way. And what happens is most funeral homes are like shared entities. So what we do is we have our like office space, and there's myself and my partner, Susanna Alba. And what we do is we partner with a crematory, and so we're able to use their facilities for all of our storing our bodies for our cremations, and that's what allows us to be 2-3 women essentially running our own funeral home. The problem is that having people shadow me is like a huge liability, because there are other bodies, and the number one thing to me is protecting the privacy of my family. So never talking about them, never posting about them on Facebook, never, like, even with Sarah, if I've ever told her anything, I'm pretty secretive, I guess, about it. It's just like my utmost priority is to just always maintain privacy, because this is such an incredibly sensitive nature. And especially with how moderately well-known our funeral home is, it's even a greater priority to be very tight-lipped and ensure that our families know that there's, you know, their grief isn't something that I'm going to be sharing with people for like a blog or something like that. So it was a very long answer for generally speaking, mortuary and other mortuaries operate the same way. So if you're in mortuary school, there is a chance for internships. But in general, if you're not enrolled in school, there aren't any. But I always tell people that the best thing to do actually before even enrolling in mortuary school is just getting a job in the industry. The greatest common misconception is that you need to go to mortuary school to work in a mortuary, which I know sounds funny because you would think that you need to. And right now, everyone in this room, once you get your driver's license and it's a valid driver's license and you're in good standing, can work as a first call driver. And that's what you should do. And then you should see if that's something that you're interested in and then go from there before going in school and going down that career path.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we have a very small staff. It started out with just my boss, who founded the nonprofit, and then I was brought on, and now we have another person. And we have, so to be clear, we have three branches altogether. There's the nonprofit, there's a funeral home that Amber runs, and we also run an event series as well. And last year, we tried really hard to find somebody to intern for us that would run our social media accounts. Right now, I think I'm running at least 8 platforms on a daily basis. It's a lot of time, and you constantly need to be on top of what the news is, what the trends are, who is doing what. And because we're talking about death and grief, it's a very deeply uncomfortable subject. So it's very difficult to get the tone and Yeah, and how you discuss the subject done in a right way. So it makes it very difficult to find somebody. Like one piece of advice that I have is that people are always watching, and we often get to know people in our community through social media or how they interact with others. So there were people that I had picked out last year that were doing just on their personal social media accounts, like speaking eloquently and advocating in a way that really reflected our values and what we are trying to do. And then right before I would offer them a job with my, you know, an internship with money and training from me, then all of a sudden they would go off the rails and post things that were inappropriate. So just keep in mind, people are always watching. Part of the reason I got my job was I did such a good job with my own personal social media account, and it was gaining so much interest on its own that people were pulling me in to do theirs. And I'm always looking at what other people are doing. What are you working on? How are you handling yourself? What kind of a person are you? And that's a lot of how we find people or offer other opportunities to people or support or scholarships, things like that. So just keep in mind that people may always be watching. So be careful what you do and say.
That is so true. And once a photo is up, it's up.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I didn't even think about that, but while you were talking about just our social media, it's such a crazy thing to have to think about now, is that you used to just create a resume and you'd put that out and you just were sort of free and clear as to your resume being your sort of avatar, the thing that says who you are. And funeral homes 100% will look at your Facebook. They will look at your social media. They will find everything they can on you, because again, a funeral home is sort of a sitting duck for lawsuits, and they don't want anybody that is going to be any sort of liability whatsoever. So again, like being really professional, knowing that you are trustworthy, that you're not just going to people get so excited about wanting to work in the funeral industry because they think that it's like, I'm going to drive a hearse and I'm going to work with dead bodies. And those are the people that funeral homes absolutely don't want to hire. They don't want those people, because you don't know what this job actually entails. And it's not driving a hearse, and it's not a lot of dead bodies. It's a lot of people being really sad, and that's a good day. And on a typical day, it's people being really angry, and they're not happy to see you ever. They don't want to be there. It doesn't matter how nice and kind and caring you are. They don't want to look at you. It's kind of like the dentist, but like worse. You know, I have a really great dentist. I don't like seeing him though. I'm there and it's terrible and it's going to cost me a lot of money and it's going to hurt. And the last thing that a funeral home wants you to do is, you know, how you're just like, ugh, had the worst day ever, totally sucked, LOL, this family came in and like super yelled at me. A funeral home does not want you to put that. They don't even want you to put like, had the greatest day at work, had a good time. They want nothing on social media. So I don't want to like, sort of, no pun intended, like, what do you say, beat a dead horse on that, but like really, like, privacy is just this huge, huge thing, because like you could be that family and someone's like, OMG, had the best day ever, and they're like, did you have a good day when my grandma died? Because that was the worst day of my life. My grandmother was everything. That's really great that you had a wonderful day. And you're thinking like, oh, I had a wonderful time taking care of you. Also, alternatively, like, oh my God, this woman yelled at me. Like, families don't want to see that either. So social media, that's like the, that should be the big takeaway from this.
Any questions so far from the audience, or I'll keep going?
Sorry.
Okay.
It's for the
podcast. Oh, all right. But what is it that first attracted both of you to the subject? Because obviously, historically and otherwise, it gives a lot of people the willies, as it were. And what was it that attracted both of you to this in a positive way?
I think for me, I always sort of jokingly like refer to myself as like a bowl in a china shop kind of person. Like I don't really have, things don't occur to me the way that they occur to other people. And death has never been something that's given me the willies. It never occurred to me that it was something that could be like that. It just always has been very much it is. And probably to give you a good example of why, like one of my dad's favorite things was to read the obituaries every day. He just like whip out the newspaper and be like, John Chapman died today. Like, who is that? Who's 36. So I like actually think that that like normalized it. I don't know whose obituaries my dad was reading, but he would just read them on a daily basis. And I think that like my parents that's just like a little like litmus test of all the other weird things they probably did when I was a child of surrounding death that just made it very normal. So it wasn't a weird thing. It didn't occur to me that it was an odd thing. And then like I worked for the Downtown Women's Center for a while, which was a really healthy background in learning like positive boundaries, but also learning how to deal with things that society does not want to talk about and doesn't want to look at, which is the homeless population. I passed like 7 homeless people on the way here. And to me, I'm just like, hi, hello, how are you doing? Have a good day. And most people just don't want to look at them. And I don't want to compare the two topics as like the same, but they elicit the same response, the same sort of fear response in society. And to me, it is the whole part of the painting that makes us human. And I just accept it and want to be part of it and make it different and force other people to think about it.
So I grew up in a film and TV industry family. Everyone in my family, except for my like abuela, was in the film industry. So I went to school, I went to work with my dad or my mom or my stepmom every day after school, summer vacation, spring break, everything. I was on a movie set. So that means I saw death being recreated over and over and over again. And when someone actually died on set during filming, I wasn't there, but my dad was there. It completely changed all of the adults around me. It came from a very open family, talked about everything. Everything was very transparent to all of the adults around me. Their behavior completely changing, becoming very closed off. And it was a very strange experience as a child, not being going from some, you know, a relationship that's very open and where everything is very transparent to all of a sudden the adults around you becoming very secretive, very closed off, hiding how they feel, closing doors. It completely changed my life and all of the adults around us. And so there was that, but I also grew up in a family, like my grandmother was very open about death and planning her funeral and asking her opinion about like, oh, hey, you know, I have these extra grave plots and what are we going to do? What food am I going to serve at the funeral and what color limousine should I rent? She had everything planned out beforehand. So death was not a hidden or taboo subject. It was something that was just a normal part of life and a normal part of, yeah, the dialogue. But that experience that I had with the adults and in the film industry, it really made me want to go, hey, what is this? Why are people reacting the way that they are? And made me much more interested and curious about why people reacted and behaved in the manner that they did. And I haven't let go of that since. And that's not to say, I don't know what your experience has been, but something I get a lot of emails about at the Order, and something that I grew up with and still deal with today, is that, why are you interested in this? What is wrong with you? Why can't you be a normal girl, or you should, you know, if you do this, you're not going to have any friends. But I get emails like that a lot from young people, particularly ones that identify as female, that their family is really shaming them for their interest in something that is a completely normal and natural aspect of our life and our existence. And how unfortunate that is, because whether it's Amber or myself or the doctors or the people that work in forensic science, these are the people that we depend on. We depend on our doctors. We depend on so many people that do these incredible jobs, who have an interest in the things that a lot of people are afraid of, whether it's how our human body functions or what happens to it when we die or how we deal with grief.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, question.
So from what you've said so far, do you believe that social media is like a bad thing that happened, like to that general job?
So just to, sorry, recap the question for recording, do you think social media is something negative that has happened in a general sense for your careers?
I think that social media, like everything, has its positives and its negatives, because if it wasn't for social media, I never would have found Sarah or Caitlin, you know, so the people that I work with, that I am able to create all of this. And what we do with social media is so amazing, and we wouldn't have had this chance without it. And that's the ability to put our message out worldwide. I get emails from people, girls and guys in New Zealand, that are like, I have been watching your funeral home and following you, and what you're doing is so amazing. And that's that's incredible. That blows my mind that there's like someone in New Zealand knows what I'm doing with my funeral home. And I think that overall it's a positive thing. I think that it's just about using it responsibly. And I think that all of us can use like a friendly reminder that it's like, yep, everyone, people are watching, the internet is forever, for better or for worse. But ultimately I think that social media is a really, really great thing.
Agreed. but, you know, part of my experience too, because I'm from LA, but up until just before this year started, I've been living the past 4 years in Central California, in a rural area that's very cut off, and it's like 20 years behind everywhere else. It's farmland. There are no opportunities for really anything. Even the library is a very difficult place to be, because you're not getting new books, or you're getting books, you know, in a very particular, you know, kind of mindset. So your access to information and new experiences and opportunity is very, very limited. So I only have the job that I have and the opportunities that I have because of social media. So it's really been a huge lifesaver for me. And also because the biggest way that we get our message out is through YouTube videos. That's definitely our largest platform by far. So we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of subscribers to our YouTube channel, and being able to educate people and share information that way has been the best. But yes, like Amber said, there's definitely a dark side to it. And there's a duality, but I think it's really important, because there are a lot of, especially families that are separated by these borders that we have to contend with. You know, I have a lot of friends and people in my community that have family in a different country, and they cannot go to be part of a funeral or a memorial process or visit with a loved one in person. But social media and the internet has provided ways for them to at least in some way be present with family members, be part of the funeral process through live streaming and things like that. So it can be a bad thing, but it can be really, really a life-saving, wonderful, wonderful thing. And I love it.
Thank you so much. I'm going to use one of my questions now. Because you're very different in terms of what you do every day. What does a week in your life look like? Broad strokes, if you'd like.
I get asked that question all the time, and I still have no idea how to answer it. It involves lots of coffee every day. That's the first thing. Nothing happens without coffee. It's a lot of, I guess to use sort of semi-general terms, it's being incredibly self-motivated. It's a lot of prioritizing, multitasking. Generally, my day starts off with going over emails and going over the schedule. So do I have any arrangements today? Do I need to go to the crematory? Do I need to go to the health office to pick up death certificates? Do I need to mail death certificates? Do I need to deliver them to someone's house? Do I need to pick up cremated remains? Do I need to deliver clothing? So all of those little facets that create the entire part of a funeral from beginning to end and after, I'm responsible for up to, you know, anywhere from like 10 to 15 people at a time. So sort of like waiting tables, which I've also done for many, many years. It really is a lot like waiting tables. Like you have five tables and you have four people at each table. So you've got, I can do math, 20 people to take care of. And each one of those people there need a different thing, and you are responsible for making all of that happen in a succinct amount of time. And somehow from 9 a.m. to 5:30 or 6, I'm still answering emails or doing something, or I'm on the road just getting stuff done. If you worked in a normal funeral home, it would probably be a little bit different because you would clock in and you would probably just have your one job that you've been assigned to. So maybe you're an embalmer, or you're an arrangement counselor, or you're a service attendant, and you would just do that one thing from beginning to end. But my day is definitely just sort of doing everything and just trying to keep myself focused as I make it through the week.
Talk about the paperwork, Amber.
The paper. Sarah knows how much I hate paperwork. Also, if you think that being a funeral director is fun because you get to work with dead bodies, like I said earlier, you don't, but you do a lot of paperwork and you deal with a lot of government entities, and you're responsible for keeping all that paperwork and filing it in a timely basis. And I hate death certificates, and I'm not going to get started on that, but because I will talk about my unending hatred for them forever. But that's about 90% of being a funeral director, is filling out and filing death certificates and delivering physical copies back to a family, because people will start calling you immediately upon someone's death for that copy of the death certificate, and they get very mad at me when they don't have it. And I have no control over how quickly it comes back. So super fun.
Yeah, my impression of your job from the outside, and like being on, you know, on kind of the fringes, is that if you love hanging out at the DMV, that this is the job for you. Yeah, it's a lot of that. My job has a bunch of different pieces to it. So part of it is focused on supporting and gets helping the founder get her job and her work out there. So she has a YouTube series. It's really popular. And she's a two-time New York Times bestselling author. So I get really, really busy when a new book comes out. That means I have to do meetings with her publisher, her team, help deal with the tour logistics, deal with speaking engagements, creating contracts, agreements, you know, taking care of details like what does the speaking setup, what kind of microphone are you having available? It's little details like that. Then there's the, because all of our funding comes from Patreon, which for those of you that aren't familiar, it's basically like a Kickstarter, like a crowdfunding source. So it, where people, the general public, can fund creators or content creators directly. So generally what happens is people pledge a certain amount, a dollar amount every month, and to support an individual's work. So a lot of my work is creating content. So articles, editing articles, finding writers, helping writers craft their piece, finding if I want to publish an article on a particular subject, finding a writer who is suited to writing about that particular subject. So there's that. There's handling all of the social media, which I think I said to do something like I run at least 8 to 10 platforms. It's exhausting on a daily basis trying to find and generate interesting, new, different content that speaks to such a wide range of people, because death, grief, dying, it's a universal experience. So I have to take what I know and try and create content and put things out there that everyone can relate to as much as possible. I have to find something to meet everyone's needs. So that can be a parent who has children, their partner has been diagnosed with a terminal disease. How are they going to plan for that and talk to the child? To what are the rights and protection for identity for people in the trans community. I have to try and make sure everyone is safe and covered. I also have to be on top of all of the laws that are coming up, and I work with a legal team that I've assembled to where we advocate and put the information out there and create action items for things that either limit or will expand our death rights. We have the videos, we have a podcast, we have all kinds of things going on. So a lot of it also is deciding what we're going to talk about on the podcast, researching it, writing stories, going into the studio and recording my section for that, things like that. Answering emails, which can be anything from, hey, thanks for your work, to the opposite, hate mails, to people that are dealing with really heartbreaking, difficult things. And so the job ends up taking just a huge emotional toll on you. There are emails I've gotten from people, and we get dozens every day. And you carry their problems with you. Like, what happened to this person? Are they okay? It's heartbreaking. And so you have to be emotionally well equipped to deal with all of the things that we're dealing with on a daily basis. And just like a million different, everything from creative things, from writing and creating the podcasts and telling stories to, you know, dealing with death laws and regulations and things like that. So it really runs the gamut of what we have to do on a daily basis.
Are you able to make your own hours, or do you have kind of a set time?
I don't have a set time because stuff comes up all the time. So I'm really working like all the time. My morning basically starts as soon as I get up. I immediately have to be aware of what the news is. So if there has been a tragedy, or there is something that the population at large is dealing with or trying to face, I have to get content out there that informs and supports people through what they're going through or what they need to know. So like, and that's the other thing that's a challenge for me, is I get no break from social media or the news or anything like that. I can't insulate myself or take a breather. I have to know what's going on every moment of the day and respond to that. And yeah, it's exhausting.
Yeah. Any audience questions? Should I keep? Yes.
Do you guys celebrate Day of the Dead?
Did you hear that?
No.
I do because I'm a Chicana. I actually traveled. One of my like research or expertise subjects is every year I actually go down to Mexico and I travel all over. So rural areas, big cities, things like that. It's really, really important to me, especially because I went through a traumatic loss. That our westernized American society definitely did not support me or meet my needs during the dying process and the grief process in any way, shape, or form. I felt like my ancestors and my family and my culture supported that much more. So helping research and learn more about all of the history and everything we went through to keep those traditions and those rituals intact and share them with my community, and helping teach them that there is a different way by decolonizing our death practices. That's really important to me, and I know for a lot of communities as well. So I do very much. And I go around and I research and talk about it a lot.
I'm Jewish. So I honor and respect everybody's traditions, but it's not something that's part of my background.
Thank you. Excellent question. Any other questions? Yes.
To talk loud, but pardon, I was a little late, so pardon that. You sound like you do so much. And you smile while you're saying all this work, so it sounds like you enjoy what you do. But if you could say what your title is, because it seems like you do everything, marketing and yeah.
She does do everything. She is the everything, everything.
So I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization called the Order of the Good Death. So that's my official title. But yeah, I do everything. I do a lot of things. And I think because of my past jobs, I've been able to pull a lot of things that I've learned, whether it's I was a teacher. So my background in education, we're educating people, we're disseminating information, and I need to make it accessible and interesting and entertaining as well, because and palatable to people, because we don't want to talk about death. So my background in education, but also as a museum curator and historian, also like I'm able to pull so many valuable skills from those things and put them into what I'm doing now. And that was one of the things I was talking about earlier, is it's hard to say how you get to where, you know, to work my position, because it's uncharted territory. And that's how it is for a lot of us that are kind of working in this alternative death thing, is that people want to know how do I do this? Did you do that? Nobody that's doing what we're doing now has done it. And the people that are doing it just kind of had to fumble their way through and be really tenacious about it. Yeah. And I love what I'm doing, but again, we're working with death and grief. It's hard and it's heartbreaking. And part of what motivates me is I don't want people to go through some of the things that I had to go through or face the things that I did. And yeah, it's really important to me to keep centering the conversation and the actions that we take around the people in the communities that are most vulnerable to. Because I feel like the media often, because we do get a lot of media attention for what we do, which is strange, but we do. And they often don't want to, they want to talk about green burial or home funerals or like
aquamation.
Yeah, aquamation, or like the cool things that you can do with cremated remains, you know, ashes, like turning them into jewelry or fireworks or things like that. They don't want to talk to me about the cost of human life at the U.S.-Mexico border. They don't want to talk to me about child and infant death, which are the things that I want to talk about. But here I am, and I'm just going to keep talking about, I'm just going to keep talking about those things, you know?
Thank you. we only have about 15 more minutes. I see a hand. All right. What's your question? Oh, no. No, I saw you.
Yeah. Oh, I already asked.
I don't have a question because
we have time for both.
No. He knows us.
I'm with Ben.
Oh, okay. Okay. My question to you is, do you think that death in Los Angeles is particular as opposed, you know, is there something interesting, different, horrifying, whatever? How does Los Angeles view death?
I haven't. Okay, so interestingly enough, Los Angeles is really the birthplace of our, of the American way of death. And it actually started at Forest Lawn, which maybe some of you are familiar with because they have kiosks in the, at the mall. They're everywhere. Before Forest Lawn existed, cemeteries, we had funerals at home. There were no funeral homes. There were no funeral directors. There were no morticians, and there were no hospitals. When people were dying, we cared for our loved ones at home. They died at home. We held their funerals at home. Sometimes there was a cemetery or graveyard at the churchyard. Sometimes we buried them on our land, but death was family and individual centered. And then the Civil War came and that changed everything. And when people saw that they could make a profit from death, that's when funeral homes became created. So before this time, cemeteries were a social place. They were basically like our parks. People had first dates there. They took their families and they had picnics at the cemetery. It's where they took a walk. They were these beautiful gardens that were basically considered like outdoor museums. There were sculptures and beautiful flowers and trees. It was just a place to hang out. And in fact, they were so popular that a lot of the cemeteries before Forest Lawn, you actually had to have a ticket to get in. And it was a way that they could control the overcrowding because so many people wanted to come and hang out at the cemetery. So then this man in the 1920s, he was a door-to-door salesman. So there were these guys that were trying to sell things like Bibles or, I don't know, pots and pans and, you know, clothes, shoes, things like that. And they would come and they would knock on your door and show you like the things they had for sale and you would order them. So there was a guy that was going door to door, knocking on doors and trying to sell grave plots in cemeteries. And he came out here to Los Angeles, to Glendale, and he was going to teach these people about how to sell grave plots. Instead, he came up with this whole idea about how he wanted to create a cemetery without death. Which sounds completely outrageous, right? Like, how did this work? But it did, and it's exactly what we do. So at Forest Lawn, like they changed the language around everything. Morticians and funeral directors became hosts and hostesses. It was no longer the mortuary or the embalming room. It was the slumber room. They took away all of the headstones and the gravestones that you think of, and they're completely flat so that people, when people look out over the cemetery, they don't see the bodies. They just see these beautiful, rolling, lush hills. They don't even have trees in there and plants where their leaves fall. They don't change and fall and die because this guy didn't want anybody thinking about death. A lot like Disneyland, they piped in like happy music and birds singing and things like that. And there's a lot of other things that they did, but basically this guy wanted to take the death out of death. And that's what we embraced as a culture. So yeah, it's very, so we have a very unique, bizarre way of doing death in Los Angeles.
Basically, that was like he created the template for everybody else. It's like the one-stop shop. So like I was saying, I think I mentioned it earlier, that the thing that you think of as a funeral home now exists basically because of Forest Lawn. They created the funeral home that has the chapel and the flowers and like the their own cemetery, which is kind of genius. Like I respect the hustle in the game. Like I'm like, yeah, that's it's great. It's because it's beautiful. I worked there. It was beautiful. I worked there because I wanted to be there because I thought it was so amazing and gorgeous and I wanted to be part of it. And I loved coming to work every day and seeing deer grazing in the rolling hills without the cemetery markers. But I also really disliked that it was like working in a Ford assembly line and I would get called into the office to talk about how I needed to tone down my excitement for being at work and because I was an embalmer. Very briefly, I did the thing that I sort of advocate against now because I needed to do a body, like dress and do the makeup in under 45 minutes and I was taking too long. And it wasn't that I was being, like I wasn't being scolded, it was understood that I was new, but they coach you from the very beginning that these are our standards and you need to be able to do this by in this amount of time, in this amount of time. And it's why I advocate now for you taking death back into your own hands because yes, there is a reverence. I don't want to say that everyone that works at a funeral home is some like monster that, you know, needs to like treat your grandma like an oil change and get it done in 45 minutes or less, like Jiffy Lube. But that reverence and the love that you see in things like 6 Feet Under, you can't keep Forest Lawn open and spend that kind of time on someone. It's why Fisher and Sons is constantly struggling, which that show takes on a whole new meaning after you've run a funeral home. You're just like, the struggle is real. So yeah, you know, I think I sort of went on a tangent.
Thank you. Did you have a question, sir?
Did you have a question? In the death care industry, don't you have to be to some degree, I don't want to say cold, but you can't take on the emotional side of it so much. Otherwise, you couldn't. I mean, you want to kind of empathize with the family, but don't join the family, in other words. You still have to be more businesslike. And the reason why I say that, because I worked at Inglewood Park Cemetery selling property, pre-need. And I did that for a while, but for many, many years, I'm an obituary writer, so my friends think I'm strange. But I enjoy it. But I also know that my enjoyment can't relay, you know, I can't share that with everyone because they'll think, you know, you're a little psychotic. So I still have to some degree be a little bit removed, but keep my emotions intact. It's a fine line to walk, but so I kind of get what you're talking about, where you know you where they say you have to do certain things a certain way. Mm.
Yeah, you have to compartmentalize.
100%. Yeah. You have to definitely have healthy boundaries. And since I know we're running short on time, I will say that I think that funeral homes. I want to say this nicely. I think that they, in trying to teach you healthy boundaries, take away a lot of the humanity. And I can only speak to my own personal experience and all of my friends who have quit multiple funeral homes because everyone that works there is extremely unprofessional. And again, I always want to be really careful and not say that it's like this at every funeral home, but if you have to treat everyone like you're on a Ford assembly line, at some point you start to lose what makes you love the job. And earlier I mentioned, so I used to work for the Downtown Women's Center, and that was incredibly difficult because you're working with women who have heartbreaking stories. It's so, so hard. And I'm so thankful for working there because I really learned how to have these healthy boundaries, which I was able to have with my families. And it's part of what made me not go completely crazy working in a funeral home. And I think that it's what saved me when I watched other girls that I worked with. The reason I don't work for Forest Lawn is because I worked with people that I thought should not be there anymore. And I didn't, they were poisoning the well. And I took myself out before I became like that because I saw what that kind of environment does to you, which again is why I always suggest people get a job in a funeral home first to see how you feel about it, to see how you yourself can handle working in that environment, because you can only control your own reactions. And you'll find that a lot of people get into this business for the wrong reasons. I don't know if the funeral industry creates that kind of mentality. You know, it sounds like you have like really good, you probably figured out, or you have healthy boundaries and were able to take that and maintain like a healthy relationship with death. I don't know if I actually answered your question or just sort of jumped on like, yes, I totally get, I get what you're saying. And yeah, it makes me sad.
Sorry. Sure. So do you think that the change came about with when large corporations took over funeral homes, when they were like mom and pop shops, were they more personable, where they weren't an assembly line?
I think so, because I don't think that my whole thing is that I think everyone should be responsible for their own family's death, because I think it's an awful lot of responsibility to put on just a few people. Because at Forest Lawn, there were 7 embalmers, and we had at any time on the floor 50 to 60 people, 35 people downstairs. Like, what does that do to your mentality every day? Like, seeing, and it's not seeing the death, it's not seeing dead bodies. They're very lovely. They're very nice, and they're not scary. And I encourage everybody to, I enjoy the serenity that it is to be with a dead body, because I use it as time to reflect on my own mortality and to continually remind myself to be the best person that I can be, because this is it. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't think that we should put the entire county, the country, the world, I don't think we should be putting all of this death on just like a small handful of people and expecting them not to go completely bonkers. It's just too much. And to do it at, you know, slightly above minimum wage, like and they're not emotionally prepared either. So as I mentioned earlier, most of these people you're getting an associate's degree, and it's not preparing you for having those emotional healthy boundaries. You're not like delving into psychology or therapy or grief management. You're not having any of the tools that you need to survive in this industry. And it's, to me, no wonder that it seems like so many people burn out after 5 or 6 years. So there's plenty of job openings. Every 5 or 6 years, a bunch of people get tired, and there's plenty of openings for you guys.
If it's okay, I have 2 more questions if you're in a huge hurry, but if you'd like to finish with that. Okay. But I did want to did I see a hand up? No? Okay. My personal last 2 questions are, 1, how is diversity in your workplace? Because I know it's an all-female staff, but how is just general diversity in the whole career choices?
The funeral industry?
Yeah.
I would say, like, from what I saw, it was incredibly diverse, which was something that made me really, really happy, as I saw, like, a healthy mixture of men, women. It's definitely more female-dominated now, and mostly young women in their 30s, which is really great. So I would say that that's a very positive thing. I know I feel like I just totally bummed out everybody about my job, which I was trying to not do when I came in here.
For our organization, which again is very, very tiny. So we have myself and another Latinx woman and a Japanese American woman as well. And so it's basically half and half. I think the big challenge is, again, because we deal with the media a lot, they really center white voices and stories. So this can be very challenging to all of the other people and all of the other communities doing this amazing work. Again, they want more uplifting stories. So green burial and wicker caskets and pretty, who's blowing glass, these beautiful glass pendants with things like that. They don't want to talk about the difficult subjects that a lot of us in marginalized communities want to talk about, are advocating for. So I can't tell you how many press requests come in on a daily basis where they just want to, it's a member of the press, they just want to do a story covering the movement. They will not talk to me. They will not talk to my colleagues of color. They only want to talk to certain individuals, even though sometimes on a subject we may be more qualified to speak about what the topic they are is covering, they do not want to talk to us. So that can be very challenging, but it's very important to keep in mind that if you're doing work in the social realm, you're trying to change our culture and our society around something, that you can't have your ego involved in any way, shape, or form. This has to be about helping people and changing the culture, not about you. You cannot center yourself. You just have to keep doing the work because you believe in it, because you're passionate about it, because you want to help people and change things. It cannot be about your Instagram followers or that, you know, you were in the New York Times for the third time. You're going to leave and get burned out immediately if that's why you are here.
And because you have to help families and help other people so much, do you find this more to be an extrovert's job, or are introverts welcome?
It's, I think, to me, 100% like an extroverted kind of job. You have to be really able to put yourself out there and talk to people and engage with them and not be, you know, when you sit down at an arrangement table with someone, I don't think that an introvert would do as well. That maybe an introvert would be good as an embalmer. And so I definitely encourage, you know, anyone to find like the part that's right for them, but definitely to be a funeral director, you need to be like extremely extroverted to sort of navigate through everything that's happening during that arrangement, whether they're celebrating a life or mourning, or they're horribly angry about everything. And sort of, one of the things that I taught Susanna that when she came in is that in this time, families sense any sort of hesitation that you have when you're in the arrangement with them. So being really confident and kind and sort of warm and embracing definitely helps, which I don't know that, like, my mom is super introverted, and I'm picturing my mom trying to do the job and she would be terrible. She would just be like, I mean, I stutter a lot, but in a still very talkative way, she would be better at an embalmer if she liked dead bodies and blood, which she doesn't. So she should just not do this job at all.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Hi, I'm here representing all the introverts because that is me, like, to the extreme. And I have to say this about our boss as well, is that she's also very much along the lines of I am, presents very much as an extrovert. Again, you have to be very passionate about what you're doing, and being able to speak and kind of get your anxiety under control to be able to advocate for the things that you think are important and to educate people. That's a skill set. You can learn those skills whether you're introverted or extroverted. You're just going to have a different experience of doing it. But for our founder, again, was introverted, and it's very scary to put yourself out there and talk about a subject that people don't want to talk about or address or face. But a subject like death, it needs humanity. It needs a human face to it. It needs people that are relatable and flawed and vulnerable. And because we believe so much in what we're doing and we want so much to support you and help you and educate you, like, it's worth putting ourselves out there. There's a place for introverts too. I proved it.
You know, you're, I like having Sarah with me because she's really good at talking, and I have like three sentence answers and I'm like, here you go.
So. And I talk too much. So.
It's perfect. You balance it out.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us today, and thank you all out here for joining us today. And come back next month for journalism.